Good morning. 9:48 a.m. Saturday morning. I think it's April the 20th. I'm sure it's Saturday. I think it's the 20th. I'm pretty sure it's the 20th. I think yesterday was, in fact, the 19th. So, anyway, I haven't heard Endomondo give me my first mile marker yet, which is a little odd, but let's see. It wasn't a slug bug day, but it was not really a record setter. Still have some significant pain in my foot. I'm walking anyway. If nothing else, it helps loosen up the pain in my back. So it's sort of trading one pain for another. It's kind of tedious. 18-minute first mile. Yeah, that's about what I expected. 18 per mile. Scoot across the road. So, yeah, second day on the milkshake breakfast. The protein shake breakfast. Yeah. The good thing, well, this morning I didn't try to put everything in a bottle and then shake the bottle to mix it up. I actually used a whisk to break up the clots, and I got much better distribution of the whey powder. So tossed in a teaspoon of chocolate syrup to help kill the chalk taste. It worked too. So it wasn't bad. It wasn't as bad as it was yesterday. Oh, yesterday was horrible. So we'll see how this works out. We'll try it for a few days. I've got a can of this stuff that's supposed to be like a 8 or 9 day supply. We'll see where I am after 9 days. I also have appointments for more medicals. Got my pre-surgery physical scheduled for Tuesday, week after next, I guess. Next Wednesday is the big eye measurement day, where I have to decide finally what sort of lens I want to put in. I've got a medium lens and a close-up lens, single focus at the moment, on my chart. And I'm able to go with a multifocus lens, which means for most things I wouldn't need to wear glasses, except possibly reading. On a grand scheme of things, I probably would be wiser to have the lenses set to close, so that reading a book I don't need glasses, reading a computer screen I don't need glasses. It's only when I get up from the desk that I need to put the glasses on. That might make more sense for the way I do my life. And I guess the big question is, what's the difference in clarity using the multifocus? I don't have any good answers for any of it. So basically I'm going with my gut and figuring that I have so little sight right now, it's going to be a huge improvement. So anyway, yeah, that's the latest on the medical front. I've got an appointment for my younger daughter to get a physical, because she's concerned that being a teenager somehow makes her abnormal, and that since every other kid in the school can get their homework done and she can't, there must be something wrong with her. Of course, the premise is flawed and unfortunately comes from a teacher who told her that every other kid in the school can get their homework done. Why can't you? I really hate it when teachers lie. I'm pretty sure that there's an awful lot of kids in that school that aren't doing their homework. my elder daughter being one of them. So yeah, this is patent bullshit, and meant to try to guilt her into getting her homework done. The fact that the kid is absolutely brilliant, bored snotless, and surrounded by people who are, in many cases, suffering from a whole variety of social, if not cognitive, ills. I guess it's not too surprising. So yesterday was kind of a hectic afternoon. I'm really glad I got my writing done yesterday before anybody got up, because I got damn little done after anybody got up, and I really wish I'd gotten my writing done this morning. But I slept in a little bit. It was like closer to 5:30 that I got up, 6 o'clock, then 4 o'clock. And so by the time I got myself settled, it was already pretty much too late for the day. So I'm not quite sure what the day is going to bring. I'm going to try to squeeze in 1,000 words here or there somewhere, just to keep the momentum going. Did 1,500 yesterday. If I could do another 1,500 today, if I could even do more. I'm aiming for a 5,000 word day, but I've reached a point in the story where I'm not quite sure what's happening. Of course, the answer to this problem that I keep having is, I'm at the point in the story where I don't know what's happening, is to write something. It's not to try to figure out what's happening. It's to sit down and, as Patrick McLean's 5-minute pep talk suggests, that first 5 minutes sucks. But if you can make it through that sucky 5 minutes, the rest is pretty much guaranteed to go smoothly. Not always, but anyway, the other bit is that I'm going to try to do other stuff besides writing. I can't write when people are talking to me. It's impossible for me to write while people are trying to have a conversation with me, because I can't jump in and out of the page. And yet people in my house seem to think that talking to me is somehow important, and that they have to talk to me right now about important things, like what are we going to have for dinner. Tonight, by the way, is going to be curried chicken. I'm sorely tempted to make hot curry, but I'm probably going to go with a garam masala base. Anyway, so I'm reading, I don't know if I mentioned this before, I'm reading Emerald City Blues, Peter Smalley. Peter's a guy I met on Google Plus, and I don't even remember yesterday. I don't remember if I talked about it. 30s era, Prohibition era, Seattle. V.I. Warshawski meets Harry Dresden, and it's really kind of cool. He's done a really good job, for the most part, of world building. But I got to one point, and I got completely thrown out of the story. I was completely derailed. And it bothered me enough that I actually wrote to him and said, I got a problem with this story. Do you want me to tell you about it, or do you want me to just sit on my hands? And he asked me to tell him, so I did. And the problem is, he uses a word that's an anachronism. Now, there's several times where he's used words that I thought were anachronistic. Now, I'm not convinced that they're not. But in this case, the word is clearly anachronistic. And the word it's actually a phrase, bed and breakfast. Now, I happen to know this is anachronistic because I have some understanding of the history of the early part of the 19th century, of the 20th century, having grown up in the latter half of it. Bed and breakfast was a new term for many people when it first was coined in the United States, or first used in the United States, because I think it was used in Europe before. But in the United States, it was first gained acceptance in the 1960s. And I was very aware of when bed and breakfast, because I thought it was, oh, isn't that cute? Isn't that odd? Isn't that funny? And living in New England, where there were a lot of little new inns, and a lot of people thinking, oh, well, I'll turn my old Victorian house into a bed and breakfast. You know, it was a movement. It was something I was aware of as a new movement in America. So when it cropped up in this 1930s, it has to be early 30s, it has to be like literally 1930, maybe 31, book, Monkpole, it was like, what? No. And then, you know, the repartee goes on to talk about quiche and cheese croissants, and it's like, wait a minute, 1930s blue-collar America? What? No. No. 1970s blue-collar America, maybe. 1930s, not a chance. So, there was that. That was a reference to John L. Sullivan. Now, you know, I know who John L. Sullivan is. I know he was one of the, you know, the famous bare-knuckle brawlers of the 1800s. But in the 1930s, the 1920s, there was a whole sort of renaissance of boxing. It was a huge, huge sport in America. Gene Tunney and Tommy Loughran and a whole bunch of other people who were really famous as boxers. So the main character, Maddie Sheehan, an Irish girl, daughter of a dead cop, private investigator with magic on the side, and she's talking about feeling like her head has been beaten on by John L. Sullivan, bare knuckle. And I'm thinking, really? Jesus, how old is this kid? I thought she was like 20-something. For her to remember John L. Sullivan as a major factor, as an imaginative referent, she'd have to be like 45. And I'm thinking, this doesn't match with anything that I'm reading so far, because her father was still in the service. He was still on the force when he was killed. Apparently, I'm not 100% sure. It's not been made clear in the story yet, but the implication is there. So she can't be 40. She has to be at the most 30, which would mean she was born at the turn of the century, which was 5 years after John L. Sullivan's last title fight, although he did do an exhibition in 1905. But still, it was like, when added to the anachronism, that was too much for me to cope with. I was like, really? What the hell is going on in this story? Is it an alternate history, maybe? But no, it's not supposed to be an alternate history. It's supposed to be, what if there is magic? What does that do to society if there is magic? Doesn't change the timeline necessarily, but what if there's magic? So yeah, the tags there were completely in. And this chapter started with I'll have to go back. The previous chapter ended with her getting clubbed over the head with a crowbar and knocked unconscious, which, yeah, as a plot device leaves a little bit to be desired, but, you know, okay, it's a noir cop story detective thing. All right, okay. And she's really too fond of booze during Prohibition. Okay, that's interesting. That's a little bit different. So, good morning. So you know, this idea that she gets knocked out was like, that didn't set me off. She woke up, the next chapter begins with her waking up in the drunk tank, which is, it's not that too far-fetched, but believing she has a hangover. And I'm thinking, really? She's waking up with a hangover. She's not waking up with, because she got clubbed in the side. She was hit hard enough to flip her over from her front over onto her back. So you'd think there would at least be some sort of bruising with the ribs and stuff, that there'd be some sort of pain when she tries to breathe, and her hands would go to her head and find an egg on the side of her head, the size of a whatever you want to call it, and, you know, maybe there'd be a little blood in her hair. And so it's clearly not a hangover, and yet none of that happens. Now, in reality, if she's gotten hit in the head with a crowbar hard enough to knock her out, there's probably a very good chance that she's got a concussion, but there's no indication that that might be the case. There's no acknowledgement of, you know, she has a headache. Well, yeah, I bet she does have a headache. She doesn't have anything else. And it's that lack of anything else that really started me going, what? Did I miss something? I went back and tried to read to see if I had, you know, I was like, is there a time cue here? Is this actually not the next day? Is this actually the next week? Or is this sometime in the future or what? No, because the detective comes in and references the bed and breakfast, which only serves to enhance my confusion. We'll call it confusion and not anything stronger. And after a bit of banter, he's going to keep her locked up. And she talks about her head feeling like it's been pummeled by John L. Sullivan, bare knuckle. And that's the point where I went, what the hell? And I wrote to Smalley and said, dude, I love what you've done right up to this point. And at this point, right here, you've lost me. You've popped me out of the story. And I gave him some suggestions, like, if he fixes the bed and breakfast line, the thing about bed and breakfast is that the first motel in the United States is supposed to be the Milestone Motel in San Luis Obispo, California, that was started in 1925. And there weren't even motels in Seattle in 1930, unless Henneman, whatever the hell his name was, who started the Milestone, managed to get up the Pacific Coast Highway that far in less than 5 years, which is not inconceivable. So there may have actually been a Milestone Motel in Seattle in 1930. But even the Waldorf Astoria wasn't built until 1931. So in the 30s, on the West Coast, the benchmarks were both in San Francisco, the Fairmont, and what was another one? Palace? Anyway, they're both in San Francisco. Los Angeles was still building, it hadn't really quite got there yet. Sure, there were some that were there, but they didn't quite have the same stature in the 30s. They gained that stature in the 40s. I think the Biltmore was down there, maybe. I don't know. Anyway, so I wrote him and said, you know, fix this and don't talk about cheese croissants and quiche. Those are just not consistent with these characters. Not even close. And in conjunction with bed and breakfast, it's something out of the 70s. It's not something out of the 30s. So I suggested he have her ask for Eggs Benedict with hollandaise on the side or something, just to have it be something that you might order if you were rich. And in one of the big hotels in San Francisco. at the Fairmont, for example. Anyway, and I suggested he could actually get more mileage if he would just add one line about her finding a goose egg on the side of her head and substitute Tommy Laughlin for John L. Sullivan, and he'd have them all three stomped right out, and it would flow much better, because she's Irish, Tommy Laughlin was Irish, Laughlin was Irish. He wasn't a heavyweight, he was a heavy middleweight or something like that, but his name, along with Gene Tunney and a couple of others, were really common names in the latter part of the 20s. And 20 minutes for the second mile, it's not too surprising. I'm just barely limping along as it goes. But I'm moving. And tomorrow's another day. It's a Sunday, and with any luck at all, I'll talk to you then.